Hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
Today, we have a really fun episode. I feel like we say that every single time. But
Our episodes are always fun.
I mean, we don't really pick the bad ones in general. So,
Not usually.
Not on purpose. Not unless there's a reason.
Yeah.
But this week, we are going to chat about the Season 5 episode 19, Folie à Deux. But before we get to this episode, we would like to read some tweets of the week.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay. Tweets of the week. These are in response to our episode, our latest episode in our mythology series, 731. And Kathy G says, great discussion. I love how Mulder's sense of humor remains intact throughout the very tense situation, especially his... Let me tell you, Scully, you haven't seen America till you've seen it from a train, which might be slash probably is David's unscripted contribution. And Kathy includes a screen cap from the script. And indeed, that line about seeing America from the train is not in the script. So I think that's a very good guess and assumption that David just ad-libbed that line, which is a great line. And obviously the... director and editor agreed because they left it in.
Yeah, it sounds like him.
It does, right?
Yeah, it sounds like that totally could have been one of his inserts. So yeah, I'm going to go with that. I like it.
I love it. That's something I did not know before, so I appreciate that. Thank you, Kathy. Isadub said, I'm glad that you confirmed that my thought that the tagline, apology is policy, is forced in this episode. I never understood why this tagline was so important. What was the deeper insight it was giving us? Finally, maybe there wasn't a lot to understand. I'll stop bothering about it. Yeah, sometimes it's a dub. As we all know, sometimes it's best just not to think too hard about
things. You know, this is a good example of there are hits and there are misses and then there are misses. Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, I get what they're trying to do. Like, they're trying to sort of push some sort of really poignant government conspiracy thing that was supposed to stick in our head, like, yeah, because it's not like it's not true. Like, the idea of apology is policy, the idea of like covering something up and just, hey, if we say we're sorry, then everyone's just going to be like, oh, okay, they're sorry, and move on, and then ignore like the trouble that's actually occurring and the horrible, awful things that are being covered up. So I mean, I get what they're trying to say, but yeah, especially the fact that, I mean, not even so much in the tagline, just the fact that they really leaned on it a lot in terms of like that final scene between Mulder and Scully. Yeah. And it just wasn't quite there. So, yeah.
It just didn't, it felt to me like they came up with a tagline before they came up with the script for the episode, because it just felt like they were writing things to go with the tagline instead of the other way around. I have no reason to believe that that's the way it went, but it just felt that way.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Erica Deb said, can I just say how much I loved your discussion of Scully's generally frustrated inner monologue? I was literally laughing out loud at where the fuck is my car after she meets with the syndicate guy and clearing Mulder's desk, too. I imagine her thoughts are often a series of grumbles and curses when working on the X-Files. I love it.
Yeah.
Yes, Erica Deb. I love that, too. That, I think that was you, Annie, that came up with those brilliant inner monologues.
You know, it seems apropos for Scully. It's not even like she hides it. It's not subtle. No. Like, no. She's quite...
We can see it on her face, right?
Yeah, just quite irked often. And I mean, I think in like the best possible way, it's almost like a parent cleaning up after their child. Like, that's what it reads to me. But like, she's like, well, I gotta do it because I love them. So here exactly. we are. And I mean,
yeah, like a frustrated fondness. Kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah. That's how I read it. But yeah, it is true. It's like these sorts of little mundane things like where's the car and like yeah. what's all this shit doing on Mulder's desk? Get it off. It's in my way. Like, I just love the idea that, I mean, again, I don't even know how much of that is Jillian's just doing it or if it's being directed at her. But like it, she just does it so well. So
she does. She just has such a handle on Scully and on Scully's attitude and relationship with Mulder that everything she does, we can imagine a whole other script inside her head, which to me is like a real sort of evidence of brilliant acting on her part, that we can sort of read a whole other monologue that's not in the script and may or may not have been directed to her, but that she's got it.
Yeah.
She knows exactly what she's trying to convey, and she conveys it without nothing over the top, but it's there.
Absolutely.
And that's just the brilliance of Jillian. Stuart Gipp said, hi, Stuart. These episodes are still shockingly daring to this day. Interesting point, Stuart. I mean, I think that's a great point about a lot of X-Files episodes. I mean, we watch it today and they still seem super relevant and they don't feel out of date at all. And I think that there's just a timeless quality, and they were especially daring for, you know, the time that they aired. And, you know, even today would seem a bit daring on a few points, even more daring than they did back then.
Yeah.
What do you think about that, Annie?
I absolutely agree. I mean, we've talked about this before, even the risks. I don't want to say risks because that sounds really over the top, but like the things that they did in the revival, it seems like they were really sort of putting it out there. Like they wanted to say something.
Yeah.
And back in the day, especially when this was airing, 95, 96, or whenever this would have been, it would have been a really kind of ripe time for this. You know, it always is, I suppose. But absolutely, yeah. I agree completely.
Yeah, for sure. Mrs. Spooky SLC says, greetings, Annie and Jen. I'm very late to the XFD pod party. First of all, Mrs. Spooky, you're never late. It's a podcast. It's forever, but welcome.
I like that. I think we need to have at some point an XFD pod party when the COVID is over. Yeah, I like that.
Let's do it.
Yeah,
oh, my God, yes. I'm dying to see people. And Mrs. Spooky continues, I adore your extremely shipper-friendly pod. I truly enjoy both of your perspectives and opinions on all things X-Files and MSR. Thank you both so much. Thank you, Mrs. Spooky, and we adore you. It's always delightful when people come to the party and join us, because you can do it anytime.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, Dr. Dana Scully X-File says, Dr. Dana Scully X-File has a little tale to share with us. Okay, here's the deal, she says. I started binge listening to the original podcast before that, the original podcast being Annie and her previous co-hosts, Charlie and Nick, before the pandemic started, and then transitioned to the Annie and Jen show, which I love. I can finally say that I've caught up on everything and have listened to every episode. But now I don't know what to do because I have listened to every single one and now I have nothing to listen to. Thank you for making my drives and laundry folding and dinner making so much more bearable. I can't wait for more episodes. Thank you, Dr. Danny Scully X-File. I love that. I love the fact that, I mean, sometimes we think, oh, we made this episode awfully long, but it's delightful to me that someone actually took like all 80 something episodes and just went through them all and is like ready for more. I mean, that's like, there could not be a higher compliment, I think.
It is. And you know what's funny is before you and I, before our iteration of this podcast, I haven't listened to those really old episodes in a very long time, but I know for a fact that my mind has changed on so many things over the years that sometimes like I'll have a friend text me and be like, wow, I listened to this episode where you were talking about XYZ like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and you have a different thought. And I'm like, yeah, well, I can be convinced, you know, I can be motivated. Time changes things.
It does. But like, don't hold us to anything we say here.
No, no. And I mean, it's just interesting to me, I think, how, maybe personally, I know your journey as well has come a long way, I'm sure, from when we first started doing it together. But certainly from 2016, when I started this podcast, my opinions have changed quite a bit over the years.
For sure.
I can't imagine what a roller coaster ride that would have been to just listen from the beginning.
That would have been so interesting, yeah. Just like the your character development as an arc over the entire podcast would be very interesting.
I shudder to think of my I remember very, very vividly that episode post my struggle too, when I don't think I have ever been so angry in my life. And I've chilled on that so much now, but I remember so vividly being so mad. Like I haven't listened to that episode ever again because I'm like, I don't need to revisit that anger, but I would actually be very interested to listen to it now and be like, God, Annie, chill the fuck out. Like, it's crazy.
I remember listening to that episode because, of course, I was a fan of the pod before I was a co-host. And yeah, I remember you were very strong in your opinions.
I was not happy.
You were not happy. And when it came time for us to do the podcast together, I kind of had a recollection of that episode in the back of my head. And I'm like, what? How is this going to go down exactly? I'm not quite sure what Eddie's going to be like to do a podcast with, because I'm just like a tiny bit nervous that it's all going to go very ragey at some point. But you've been very delightful to work with. Look, I have never been concerned.
I am only ragey when it's warranted, and I will stand by that.
I totally agree with you. We're generally very mild mannered, and when we're not, it's for a damn good reason.
Exactly.
So I'd be curious to hear if Dr. Dana Scully X-File has any more insights. Her story reminds me of, I totally feel her when she says she has nothing to listen to now, although, you know, we're churning out these episodes for you there, Dr. Dana. So I'm glad that we're still making some. When the pandemic began, like last March or so, my husband Sandy and I couldn't stand watching the supper hour news, which is normally what we do while we're having supper. We usually watch the news, but when the pandemic started, we're like, no, this is not good for our mental health.
No.
And so at supper, we started watching all the episodes of the Canadian sitcom Corner Gas, which is a great show. Watch it if you haven't. On the States, you can watch it on Amazon Prime. And we love it. We've always loved it, but we watched all six seasons. And we thought, okay, we're going to watch this every night. And by the time we get to the end, the pandemic will have been over and all will be well. The pandemic will end before we get to the end of season six.
Little did we know.
Well, yeah, let's just say we got to the end of season six quite a long time ago. And then we were like, do we do now? The pandemic's not over yet. So I totally feel for Dr. Dana Scully X-File when you kind of come to that thing that you've kind of just been kind of not having to think about what should I listen to or what should I watch. You've already got that thing. And then you've got to kind of think of something new. So I totally feel you. It's just when you think that you don't need something more to continue to entertain you, you always do.
You can always rewatch The X-Files. That is quite a feat, and it will take up a lot of time, and it will be well worth it. So
absolutely, 218 episodes, that's not going to let you down ever.
No,
so
never.
There's always the X-Files, and it's always enjoyable and always comforting to watch. I do, when I'm stressed, I do like watching things that I know already, so that I don't have to use a lot of like brain processing power. Mm-hmm. Just like I let it wash over me like a pleasant wave. So it's a great thing to watch for times like that. So thanks, Dr. Dana Scully X-File, and everybody who's sent us their thoughtful tweets this week. We love hearing from you guys. We love talking to you guys on Twitter. Please do tweet at us at XFD Podcast, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
Folie à deux. How was my French, Jen? Was it all right?
It was actually pretty good, yeah.
All right, good, 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 good.
Yeah, yeah. Nice.
A madness shared by two. I know, we all know this, but we should say it. Writer Vince Gilligan. It's funny because I knew this was a Vince Gilligan episode, but as I was watching it, I was like, this is Vince, right? It's Vince.
Yeah.
And directed by Kim Manners. So essentially the dream team here.
Right, yeah.
I mean, Jen, where does this overall fall in your ranking? Because I consider Folie à deux like one of the greatest episodes of the series.
Yeah. I can tell you exactly where it falls in my ranking, at least in my most recently made ranking. I put it at number 20 my top 25.
I'm going to look at mine now that you're saying that.
But you know what? After rewatching it a couple of times this week, I feel like I should have put it higher. I mean, I've always loved Folie à Deux, but sometimes I forget how great it is. And I love it more every time I watch it. And can't say that about every single episode. And Folie à Deux is in that category. And when I started to kind of break down what's going on in the episode, it made me admire it even more. So I actually would probably put it higher than that now.
Mine, I just checked my list, is 14.
Nice.
I mean, I was going to say last night, I was like, definitely a top 20 ep, but it's a top 15 ep for me. And I stand by that. Yeah. I think it is perfect. I think it's near perfect. I mean, I would probably rank it up like, and I got some pushback on this a couple of years ago for even suggesting such a thing. But, you know, I would actually probably compare this as like, to say maybe like Pusher as one of the greatest episodes to like show maybe a new person who has never seen the show before. Because I know that question comes up a lot, like, oh, my friend really wants to watch The X-Files. What episode should I show them? And like Pusher is always the first one that jumps to my mind. Like that's like the perfect episode. I think this one is just as perfect as Pusher. The only thing that I think keeps me from saying people should watch this one is because the characters are in a slightly odd place, which I'm sure we're going to talk about once we start getting into the nitty gritty here. So unless you kind of know the characters and know what's going on, you could come into this thinking that they're people that they're not, perhaps.
Yeah.
So that's the only reason that I would probably maybe not say watch this one first. But I think it's just as solid an episode. I think it's fantastic. Great. Yeah. I mean, everything about it is so awesome. Love it.
Very solid. Very, very good.
So, I mean, let's jump right into this, shall we? This is the one everyone knows that takes place at this telemarketing vinyl, right? I don't know. It's not telemarketing, but they're like selling.
I guess it's telemarketing.
Is it? Okay. Well, it's, you know, classic dead end job. And you have a disgruntled employee. Who maybe not so disgruntled, but he could come across as disgruntled, who thinks that he sees the boss as a monster. And we've talked about this in the past as one of the scariest monsters, I think, because and it's not even that the CG is like particularly great, but that sound.
Yeah.
Right?
It's that sound.
It's like.
Yeah. Oh, and, don't do that. You're freaking me out.
It's like a bug, like flapping its wings. It's so creepy and it gives me the heebie-jeebies. And I still find it really scary.
It's very, very scary. Whoever came up with the sound gets really a lot of the credit for this because it's not like a sound I don't think that you would automatically think to associate with a monster. It is just a very creepy insecty sound.
Right.
And it goes really well with the visuals because it is kind of insecty, but it's also very, it's always a little bit blurry and sort of moving around, which from what I've read on Wikipedia, and I think I've heard this before, they introduced that effect to the monster because they thought the monster was not convincing in and of itself.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, like, if it was just a guy in a bug costume walking around, like, nobody would think that this is... I mean, and it made me think about what we were talking about when on one of our recent episodes, we were talking about Arcadia. That's, like, a really great episode, but the monster just sucks. And it's one of those things where it's, like, how long... Like, don't you think that if maybe they had come up with some really kind of cool, unique sound effect or something? Like, what a long way that would have taken that not scary monster. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. It doesn't... You just have to do a little post-production, as it turns out. Because it was just... It was, in fact, a gal in a suit, a rubber suit, basically, apparently. A prosthetic suit, as it's described.
Yeah.
And they realized it was not working. Like, they could just tell. And so they kind of took it in post-production and added some effects to it.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, the noises were probably always going to be added to some extent, I imagine. But I think the sounds and the visuals go together in the sense, not just that it's a bug, but the way it's just kind of very ephemeral, like it's there but not there, and the sound is kind of like very sort of there and not there as well. It's not like screeching or anything like really sort of identifiable. It's just barely there, but it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems to somehow match this sort of fluttering. It's a fluttering sound and it's a fluttering visual, and it just goes really well together. And I love this idea of how the monster is presented, because it seems very much like something you'd see out of the corner of your eye. Like, that's how we would see things out of the corner of our eye.
Right.
And that makes it even creepier. It just feels very, very creepy. And they really use it to its best effect. Less is more with this monster. We see it behind, like, frosted windows. We see it behind curtains. Mm-hmm. And it works best when we see less of it. And it just worked out. It was one of those situations where they took a negative and really turned it into a positive.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wonder if this is one of those things that became sort of like a happy accident. Like, oh, we can't film it just as a bug, you know, like a man in a bug costume. So I guess we're going to have to do it this way. But it actually, I think, fits the narrative better in terms of this is not, we're not really supposed to know what's happening. Like, this could be a hallucination in this guy's mind. The entire time we're really not sure if we're really seeing it. I mean, we believe Mulder at a certain point because it's Mulder, but I think for a while you're supposed to really not know, like, what's actually going on. And so I think that actually works to great effect with that added fluttering that you're talking about with the image flickering. It makes more sense in the story to do it that way. So, I mean, I wonder if, like,
maybe they
realized that, or if that just was a product of necessity here. I
maybe a little of both. Who
maybe
knows?
A little of both. Very curious.
But yeah, that's a really good point, that it does make it seem less solid, literally. And so, and ergo less sort of like, is it real? Is it not?
Right.
And that's a really key part of the episode, is not knowing if it's real or not, especially
Absolutely.
For the first half or so. So that it just really came out really well. It wound up being, I think I not too long ago may have said this was my favorite monster. And I think I stand by that. It's my favorite monster on The X-Files. And I'm not generally like a huge monster fan, but this one, it's really very scary. And I really like it a lot, actually.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I think it's great.
It's awesome.
So, I mean, let's talk about, well, we talked about the monster quite a bit. So let's talk about Gary for a moment.
Yeah.
Before we get
Gary
to Mulder and Scully. This is actually a really kind of an interesting, I mean, this is definitely from, we get the perspective of both Mulder and Scully throughout this episode, but we also get kind of a Gary POV. Like, we are sort of, we're sympathetic to him kind of from the start, because we are seeing what he's seeing. And even if we don't know what's exactly happening to him, we can sort of get where he's coming from. And I think that was a really cool choice of them.
It was a great point. I think that we only see the monster from Gary's point of view until the very end of the hostage taking, when Mulder sees it, which we're quite well into the episode at that point.
Yeah.
So it does seem like when everyone's treating Gary like he's crazy, he seems like he might very well be. But like you say, we still sympathize with him, though. Mm-hmm. Even when he's doing like horrible things, we can still kind of see why he's doing it. We don't necessarily believe him. We don't necessarily believe him at that point that it's a real monster, but we believe that he believes it. And
exactly.
So it's still kind of very questionable about whether he's right or not, but he certainly is a sympathetic character, because we know that he definitely believes it, because we do see it from his point of view.
I want to give the actor a shout out, Brian Markinson, who I think did a fantastic job as Gary throughout. Like, really good, like, just ratcheting up the tension. He was this great everyman character, but you absolutely believe that he was losing his shit. So, like, well done, Brian Markinson. And I think what this episode does so well is, it, like we were just discussing, it puts us sort of into Mulder's perspective, because Mulder is the one who is always going to be sympathetic to these people. Like, he's always going to give them that benefit of the doubt. He's always going to have that tiny sliver of, well, or more than a sliver, of belief that this person is telling the truth. And I feel like we were put into that position from the cold open. Like, we are the ones that are like, well, this guy's, he's being an asshole, but like, we have this information and we have this belief because we saw it. Like, we believe it. And so in a way, I feel like they sort of put us in Mulder's shoes throughout this episode, which I think is fun when they do that. I think sometimes they switch it up and like, we're kind of more coming at it from a Scully viewpoint.
Good point.
This is one of those where we're kind of forced to believe it. So I enjoy that.
Great point.
So, I mean, how would you perceive the character of Gary, like, as this episode unfolds, in terms of like, how the viewers, I suppose, perceive him?
Yeah, I think, as I said, we're sympathetic towards him, but I think largely speaking, I don't think that we're given any real reason to question whether he's crazy or not. I think that honestly, it's generally presented as that he's being delusional. Even Mulder doesn't really believe him at the time of the hostage taking, because like he doesn't seem to be quite buying it. He's confused about everything that's going on. I don't feel like he's totally getting Gary's perspective until Mulder sees the monster for himself.
Okay, that's interesting that you say that, because I feel like I viewed it completely opposite. Like I,
really?
Yeah, up through the whole beginning. I mean, maybe it's because I have the benefit of knowing that I'm watching an X-Files episode and that there's probably a monster, that I feel like it's this sort of rare, like you're watching this guy who presents to everyone else as crazy, but we know he's right. And because of what we're seeing. And
I think that I would tend to agree with you more if there was ever a point that we saw the monster from another point of view other than his.
But that's the whole point of the episode, is that no one else is seeing it but Mulder.
Well, yes, but there could even be like a time where it's like, I don't know the TV terminology, but like a third person omniscient would be what we'd say in the literature world, where let's say that Mr. Pincus is in his office by himself and the door closes, someone leaves, but the camera stays on Mr. Pincus, and we, the viewer, see, oh my God, he's turned into the monster.
Okay.
Then we as viewers know it's a legitimate belief that he is in fact the monster, but we never see it except literally as Gary's looking at it. That's the only time we ever actually see a monster. I mean, I certainly take your point. It's the X-Files, so probably it's going to turn out to be a monster.
Yeah, maybe that's just my...
But you're not necessarily given a reason to sort of go on board with him, other than the fact that it's an X-Files episode.
Right. I mean, I feel like that's maybe just my natural bias when I go into an X-Files episode, is that I'm always going to believe these people. Because even though I'm not generally like a believer, like that wouldn't be what I would consider myself, I'm probably much more of a Scully than a Mulder in general, I can kind of suspend all of that disbelief when I'm watching the X-Files, because I'm like, okay, well, clearly we're gonna see something fucking weird here. So I'm watching it and I'm like, okay, all right, this guy sees this monster that's clearly real and no one else can see it, so no wonder he's going crazy. Like, that's my narrative as I'm watching it. But I think what makes this episode so unique and interesting, and then maybe this is where we can finally, you know, 20 minutes into this or whatever, dive into Mulder and Scully. I think that's what makes it so interesting, because we start off this episode with Mulder sort of in the middle of his post-Patient X, Red in the Black crisis of faith that he's experiencing. And it's funny, I watched this episode with my husband and I kind of had explained that to him, because he was like, I think he was slightly confused, like, wait, why is Mulder being like that? And I'm like, well, he's in a little bit of a funk at this point.
He's in a funk.
Yeah. And I mean, even Scully knows it, which I enjoy, because she's very much like, wait, you know, he said we, not you. He said we. And like, Mulder's already sort of pulling back from her, which is interesting. I have other things to say about that. But I really like the way they flipped that on its head in season 5, which I know we will get to eventually when we get there with our mythology arc. But I think that's what makes this interesting, is that Mulder starts off this episode not believing, which is never the case. Like, has that ever happened? Like, can you think of any other than Patient X and Red in the Black, which that's the entire point of the episodes.
Yeah.
I can't really think, I'm sure they exist, but I can't think off the top of my head of other
not
episodes.
Off the top of my head, no.
Yeah, where Mulder's
the one.
Not
this clearly, for sure. Yeah. Because he's very clearly, like, not on board with this in any way, shape, or form. And, I don't think he's remotely even interested in it until he's well into it.
Yeah.
Like, usually, you know, usual Mulder would be at least vaguely interested in the case, even if he doesn't think it's going to go anywhere. Because we've certainly seen plenty of examples where he doesn't think it's going to turn out to be much, but he's still curious. Mm-hmm. He's not even curious.
Or he just wants to take Scully to a football game, you know, something or other. He's
something
usually
like this.
Usually gung-ho about it. And for whatever,
he's not remotely gung-ho.
Granted, and we need to mention this because I think it's a huge kudos in the continuity department, that this episode comes right after Pine Bluff variant, where Mulder has his fingers broken. And they're very obvious about that bandage.
They are so proud of that bandage.
And they should be, because it's one of those things where they're like, look, you guys, we're doing continuity, right?
Continuity, like, baby. Yeah. It's like, wow. Like, they're literally almost, they are literally rubbing it in our face. Like, could Mulder be holding it up in front of the camera any longer in, like, that practically the first scene that he's in?
You're going to hate me.
Look at us. We have continuity.
You're going to hate me for saying this, but you know what I'm going to say, right? It reminds me of when he's waving around his wedding ring. It's the same.
Oh, shit. That's exactly what it's
right?
like.
Right? He's like, okay, look at this, you guys. Look at this. You got to. Oh, yeah. Have I put my hand up long enough for you guys to register this? Okay, I'm going to put my hand down right now.
Yes, exactly like that. The gesture might be identical. We could do side-by-side gifts, and I bet you they'd be very similar.
I think you're right. I love it. But I think this is just definitely worth pointing out, because I know people give this show shit for its continuity.
Yeah, but they are so proud of it, and so they should be, good for them. Gold star for Vince Gilligan and or Kim Manners, whoever knew to do that.
Mm-hmm,
good
mm-hmm.
for you. You did so great. We're proud of you.
I love it. I wish they had given Scully's tattoo the same attention, but that's another conversation.
Yeah, it really is.
But I mean, this—it's not hard for them to remember from one episode to the next. See, that's why it's easier to remember, right?
But you know, it still doesn't happen as often as I would like between one episode to the next. So I'll take it.
It's a really good point, but I think this just makes me laugh so much because it's really unnecessary. I mean, like, if they hadn't put the bandages on his. On his fingers, nobody would have been like, well, his fingers are fine. Yeah, nobody would have even noticed.
I would have just thought, okay, enough time has passed.
Has passed that they're healed.
I mean, yeah, fingers do heal. That's how it works.
Yeah. So
they really wanted to do that continuity. For some reason, they were determined. Maybe they really wanted to draw out some, like, continuity of theme with Behind Bluff variant and continuity of characterization. I don't know.
It's so funny because I feel like there are obviously times where they're really bad with continuity, but then there are times where they're actually quite good with it. And I feel like there's some sort of like continuity gas that, like, somebody is turning on and off in that writer room where they're like, let's turn on the continuity gas today and see what happens. And I swear to God, it's sometimes they do that and this sort of thing happens. Or sometimes they do that and then something else happens that we all write off as a coincidence. But really, it was the continuity gas. Like,
it was the continuity gas. Yes. I'm going to suggest that the continuity gas machine is always on.
Always
but occasionally
on.
It runs out. And then no one notices that it's run out. It takes them a while to refill it. And then once they do, boom, boom, it's all it is firing literally on all cylinders at that point.
But we know that it's
when
it's off. The funny thing is like, I feel like with most shows, they could literally just hire a fan and pay them like $5 an hour or nothing.
They wouldn't have to pay me any.
And they would just do it.
I would pay them.
Yeah. Yeah. I swear to God, they need more TV shows need to do this, because I understand. I work in television. I understand that this is not the thing that's at the top of these people's priority list. They have shows to get out. They have shit to do every week. I get it that these things fly under the radar and people forget. But if they had like one person, like one fanatical person that was paying attention to everything, that could catch these things, that would benefit them so much.
And, you know, we're not asking them to, like, you know, do like anything major that's going to like disrupt the flow of your episode or anything. A lot of the continuity problems are just tiny, tiny
super
things.
Super easily fixed.
So easily fixed.
Yep. And that's.
And yeah. I mean, which of us wouldn't have volunteered for that job? Yeah,
seriously.
So,
I mean,
that's what I would do. If I was running the X-Files, I would hire a fan to do the continuity. Mind you, there'd be the danger. If you hired me, I'd be like, can they kiss now? And they'd get really tired of me saying that.
They would be. You would be fired. And then
I would get fired.
Getting paid a continuing amount of zero. But it still would have been a great run, right?
So good.
Yeah. I would have taken that job, too. It's funny, though, because, like, I continue to think that the bad continuity at times is intentional. I really think that it is, because I feel like they're intentionally trying to be contradictory to create more questions. I'm not suggesting that I am not. I promise you, Jen, suggesting that that explains or excuses all of it. It doesn't. But I think it excuses some of it.
I like that.
Because
I think that idea.
Even Chris Carter has said that, like, look, a lot of these don't necessarily take place on a certain date. Like, they could drop in anywhere. And I mean, you look at things like Scully's hair, it just randomly fucking changes at will. And like, you know, it's one of those things that I'm like, yeah, like this really could just kind of lift out and go anywhere. And so if there isn't like an actual date in it, like we could just kind of pretend it goes here or there. I'm not suggesting that people do that, but I am saying that like the fact that he said that, I think has some weight that,
yeah, absolutely,
he doesn't really care at the end of the day about some of this stuff. Because I think it adds to the confusing, contradictory narrative that he is trying to create. That's all I'm saying.
All right. Okay. It's sort of like a campaign of confusion.
Yeah, it is a campaign of confusion, and we all willingly participate. And some of us,
I couldn't get nothing,
including myself. But yeah, there it is. So okay, so let's move along here. Mulder, he wants to go off and sort of do this on his own. I'm not really sure why he's acting like this, other than the fact that like he's having this crisis of faith or whatever. But I actually sort of put this in through like this theory into my mind that I had never really put together before. The fact that especially later when he tells Scully, "I'll prove it without you," and he's going off on his own and he's doing all this stuff, and we're one episode away from the dreaded Diana Fowley. Then we're one more episode away from Fight the Future.
Yes.
And I never really sort of, I have thought long and hard about the continuity of like the end to Fight the Future to the beginning. And I have come up with a very solid theory in my mind of why Scully thinks these things about Mulder and why she thinks he thinks this way and why he suddenly has to say to her what he says in the hallway. But on the back of this, it kind of like, I never really put that together with this. He's pulling away again, and he's literally telling her, well, then I don't need you.
Absolutely. You know what? I thought of exactly that when I was watching it this time around. I haven't before, but there was something about when I watched this episode, I got such sort of Fight the Future vibes throughout, really. Sort of the whole theme of how Scully fits in with the partnership, and to what degree does Mulder need her? To what degree does he express that? And there's a lot of thematic continuity, I would argue, more from this to Fight the Future than there is from the end to Fight the Future. And I really find that very, very interesting, because I hadn't really thought of it before. I don't know to what degree Vince Gilligan was trying for that, but that's certainly how I read it now. And it feels very much like it belongs where it is.
I mean, I have to think, as much shit as we literally just gave them about the continuity gas, they all have, like, the Fight the Future has been filmed. Like, they're doing they're doing pickups at this point. It's done. Like, it's in the can. Everyone on the team knows what happens in Fight the Future at the point when they're filming these episodes. So I have to believe that some of this stuff was intentional. And I mean, you say you don't see the continuity between the end to Fight the Future, but I really do. I feel like, regardless of all the romantic shit we don't even need to bring up about Diana Fowley, I feel like the idea of bringing in another person that vibes with Mulder in a different way is just kind of the cherry on top of the shit cake for Scully that has started to happen already when he's sort of pulling away from her, you know, like, oh, not only is this already happening, like this new person has now come in that is going to give him the things that I can't. And so those insecurities, I think, are very, very important going into Fight the Future, regardless of whether or not they're mentioned. And I think that this show does that so well. It really has so much going on with like just the subtext, like the things that we pick up on as viewers that like we don't really need to hear about Diana Fowley. We don't really need to hear about Folia De when we're watching Fight the Future to sort of pick and choose and find these little moments to sort of add to that tension leading up to that scene in the hallway. And as much as I love this episode and I've seen it a million times, I don't think I've ever actually made that connection from that line to Mulder. Mm-hmm. And the way Scully feels, you know, technically two episodes from now. And I just found that, again, one of those other things that if it wasn't intentional, well, you know, bravo, guys, because it really lines up super well.
Yeah, I agree. And that thought kind of popped into my head in terms of the connection with Fight the Future throughout the episode. But especially in that scene right at the beginning where Scully says, "You're saying I a lot, I heard we." And so there's already that question of, what is my place here?
Exactly.
And I mean, that's a theme, of course, throughout the whole series, but especially in Fight the Future. And so, yeah, I didn't really make that connection before. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I definitely made it now. And it makes me, it's one of the reasons why I like Folie à Deux even more than I did before, I think, is because I can see how well it fits into its place in the series.
Yeah. I mean, and yeah, you're right. You mentioned that this is sort of a thing that has happened throughout the series. But I mean, there's a really interesting sort of ebb and flow to the way mm-hmm. that Mulder reacts to their, or the way that Mulder treats their partnership, and then the way Scully reacts to it. And I feel like this, like you said, is placed perfectly in that quote unquote ebb at
yeah.
this point.
Yeah, because we're seeing Scully, not just, you know, Mulder going off and doing his own thing, which we see a lot, but, or Mulder thinking of the X-Files as his own, which we also see a lot, mm-hmm. but we see Scully addressing that and pushing back on that, which obviously yeah. is a big part of Fight the Future. And so I think that must have been what kind of triggered it for me, is that she's like, you know, she's calling him on it. And so it matters to her. She's showing that it matters to her.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to me. I mean, everything about their character and partnership throughout this episode is interesting.
Yeah. I apologize for jumping way forward, because we literally jumped past the entire hostage situation, which we need
that's
to get
okay.
to.
That's okay.
But that's
all
okay.
Right.
We do that
we're
around
being,
here.
We're being thematically consistent, I feel.
We are, because I think yeah. we were talking about their sort of journey in this episode.
Yeah.
And we'll get to the good stuff later. How's that?
Yeah. It's all good stuff, Annie.
It is all good stuff. But I should say the more positive stuff, I should say.
Yeah,
the shippy stuff. How about that?
The shippy stuff.
That was the,
yeah.
That's the on-brand stuff. So let's go back to Mulder. I do love that scene where he's figuring it out and he kind of calls her and he's like, all right, I think it's time for you to come out. And he's like, at the risk of saying I told you so.
Yeah.
And she's like, I told you so. They're so playful.
I
love their season 5 playfulness. It's just so
great.
Delightful to me.
It's so I love that. That scene is just, I forgot what perfection that was about.
Yeah.
I told you so. And then she says, I told you so. Because she does it in such a deadpan way.
Uh-huh.
And it's just so the timing and delivery is perfect. It's just very, very funny to me.
And his reaction is just that of a person who knows another person so well. And I mean, it's just one of those little tiny little ticks David does. Or not, I don't want to say tick, but like the tiny little acting things he does where he, you can see it on his face. And I mean, again,
yeah.
people always give him shit for being monotone, but like he does so much with his face sometimes that
yeah.
it amazes me how much he can sort of convey in a moment like that. And I love it.
Yeah, yeah. He does a lot of great face acting in this episode, honestly.
He does a lot of lip biting in this episode.
Oh, baby.
I enjoyed that.
Always a nice addition to any episode.
Yeah. And I must say later when he gets hit, like the makeup on his fat
yeah.
lip, fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just one of those things. It's like, it's just a fat lip, but it looked so real that,
you
know.
It looked very real, and they didn't have to put as much effort into it as I presume they did, but they really did go all for it.
It looked
very, you know, shout out to the makeup people.
And I didn't even look up if like they ever won any awards for this episode or season or whatever. But I wanted to say the makeup people overall in this episode look like those zombies could have looked really silly, but they looked really freaky. I think they did a really
did.
Good job with them. Yeah.
You're right. They didn't overdo it, but mm-hmm. they made it just enough to make them scary and inhuman.
And I think that's a lot of, you know, credit goes to, well, the actors, but the credit goes to like the directing and the editing. I think all of that together, again, it's just one of those things where I look at this show and I'm so in awe of how well this team of people can put together such a really great show. Sorry,
yeah.
I could go on and on about that. But I just thought the makeup department, great. They don't ever really get a shout out from us unless it's like some horrible monster.
Yeah.
But I just did want to say, in general, makeup department, bravo, guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's go back to this hostage situation. Mulder shows up, and I think this scene still affects me to this day, just because the idea of this happening is so like a common fear nowadays. Like it's sort of in the zeitgeist that like, oh, anyone could just go crazy and shoot up your office.
Yeah.
And I mean,
and I'd say it was very much the zeitgeist in the 90s too. It was still like a relatively new phenomenon, but it was definitely a thing at that point, and something that was like a relatively new fear, but definitely a fear.
Right. Right. I just think this scene was done so well though. It's like he's walking through, everything kind of looks normal because they filmed this how you would feel as Mulder walking through this office. They did it so, I'm like, I'm getting chills thinking about it because it was just so well done. Bravo, Kim Manners.
And it's very well done. It's very intense, isn't it?
It is. It really is. And I mean, I was abruptly reminded of Dwayne Barry, which I'm sure you were, because this is the second time that we have had Mulder in a hostage situation, although slightly different. I mean, it's slightly different.
Yeah, slightly different. But, you know, we see him doing a lot of the same kind of techniques. You know,
yeah.
He's talking to Gary the same way he talked to Dwayne. And he's in a very similar scenario where he's dealing with someone with delusions. Although,
or at
in Dwayne,
least we think that they're delusions. I will still go back to, I mean, with Dwayne Barry, we also sort of weren't sure if he was really seeing what he was seeing or if he was delusional.
We had reason to question him. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, like you said, like, I think we're supposed to believe him, but we're also supposed to be very wary. Like, so I think that's the, like I said, that's the position Mulder is in general. Like,
yes,
he wants to believe him. He wants to believe.
But he's
cautious.
But he's
not
sure.
Yeah. That tiny Scully voice in his head that's saying the guy has a gun, he's fucking crazy, is like definitely going off in Mulder's mind. And you can see it throughout this scene. Like the tension in this entire hostage scene is so good. Like you just said, it's such a great tense scene. Let's briefly mention and shout out to the actor who plays Mr. Pincus, the boss, John Apicella?
Apicella? Yeah, I don't know, but he's great, right? He seems so inherently likable.
Yeah, and he's familiar. I feel like he's one of those guys I've seen on some other show, and
yeah,
I can't.
Yeah, he's got one of those faces, I think. Yeah, he definitely seems like he shows up on TV a fair bit, and he's very, very good in this.
He is. I mean, it's funny because he hams up that terrified, sad face to the point where you're like, I know you're a monster, but I feel bad for you. What's wrong with me? And I mean, I think that's like a really good actor. He's
and
doing
honestly,
great.
Yeah, and at that point, for me personally, I think I was still kind of on the fence about whether he was really a monster. I think I was also thinking, while I knew it was an X-File, I think part of me thought the X-File was going to turn out to be the inducement of delusion. Like something like
it makes you think that way.
Or, yeah, something along those lines. Exactly that. You're imagining things. You're shooting you're shooting someone that you think is your husband, but it's not. That kind of thing. So I thought it might turn out to be that. And so I think that's why I was still slightly on the fence about whether he was a bad guy. And he did have such puppy dog eyes that it's like he can't really be a monster, can he?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I wanted to compare it too, and I was curious if you thought of this at all, to what Jackson can do in the revival, because it's like it's almost like you are making one person see something.
That's right. Yeah, that's very much like the kind of theory.
Yeah, which again, not intentional, I'm sure, but it's just one of those things that I'm like, oh, okay, well, is it the same? Is this guy an alien? Maybe. I mean, it fits into the lore that maybe he's
could have been anything.
Got alien technology and he's able to do this. You know, it's interesting. It's just an interesting thing to think about.
There could be a couple of explanations. Well, up until the end of the hostage situation, that's when kind of the number of possibilities narrows down considerably, but never 100%. But we'll talk about that.
Yeah. And then there was one more officer, Cross, I guess. I wanted to give a shout out.
Roger Cross.
Or sorry, officer, his name isn't
Roger
Cross.
Roger Cross. Agent Rice.
He was Rice, thank you.
I'm the number one Roger Cross fangirl, I think.
Yeah.
Because I love him.
He is a regular on this show.
It's a very special occasion. Whenever he's in an episode, I always say this every time, but I'll run down the other episodes he was in. He was a guard in EBE. I think I'd forgotten this one. He plays Private Kittel in Fresh Bones, which I'm thinking is a pretty minor role because I don't remember it. I knew him best as SWAT Lieutenant Brophy in Pusher.
Oh, yeah, Pusher. Another little Pusher connection.
And another little Pusher connection. And last but not least, he made it all the way to the revival. He was in season 11 in Familiar. He played Officer Wentworth. So
I love that.
Roger Cross, I love him. There's something about his voice. It just really does things to me. So
he's dreamy.
I'm a fan. He's extremely dreamy. Mm-hmm. I really like him, especially in Pusher, because he's in that SWAT uniform. But I mean, I like him in this too.
Yeah, I love that. He's great.
He's great.
But I had to give him a shout out too. Of course.
Yeah, you
we
know
knew.
I'm a fan.
Yeah. I wanted to bring up let's talk about Scully for a little bit. Okay.
Because I always enjoy that.
Yeah, we all do. Mulder is clearly in peril and Scully is aware of this. It's so funny because, like, how often does Scully, like, pull up to a situation where she's like, oh, God, not again. Like, literally, we should make a tally because it's so often that she's just like, what has Mulder gone himself into?
Seriously.
But it is a really great opportunity, besides her, you know, janky-ass parking job, which Jillian is always great at.
I love the camera work in that, though. Yeah. I mean, like, that cameraman's clearly, like, literally just running.
Yeah.
For that, and I don't know if they didn't have steady cams at that point, but the camera work's not super steady, perhaps on purpose. Yeah. I just find it all, yeah. Her driving is like, whatever, she's just all over the place. The camera's all over the place. It's a very dramatic entrance.
My goal is to stop the car and get out. It doesn't possibly matter where the car ends up. This is how Gillian Anderson parks. But I love that she gets out, immediately takes charge of the situation. And I really love how she handles it. And she gets all these great scenes with Roger Cross, which is also great.
Which was great. And she's in kick-ass, but also concerned mode. So I like that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I mean, this is one of those things where she doesn't really know what's going on yet inside. And so, like, she has one sort of objective. She's like, okay, we save the hostages. We get Mulder out. These are the things that we need to do. And Scully's sort of reaction and her, you know, skepticism and belief and all the traditional stuff we usually get from her doesn't really come into play until after the situation resolves itself.
Right. Yeah, because it doesn't really have anything to do with just a standard hostage situation at this point.
Exactly. But I do love her being out and, like, kind of calling the shots and everyone's, like, listening to her. I really enjoy that because it's like, she's the only one there who is not a member of SWAT. And, like, they're like, no, listen to her. She knows what she's talking about. And I just enjoy that immensely.
She just has the air of authority and wisdom about her.
As always.
Everyone knows it. They know they have to listen to her. And so they should, because as soon as they don't listen to her, problems start.
We love Scully in these situations. And we have to say it.
Oh, man. It's just, it's right up there. Like, it just, it's kind of the same mode she's in where it's all about pick up the phone and make it happen. It's that, it's that kind of Scully.
Same vibe.
It's my favorite Scully. Yeah. Ugh. Same vibe.
Same vibe. I have one plot related question to ask you about this scene. Okay. But before all I do, I do need to give a quick shout out to Mark Snow, who is clearly, like, utilizing the Fight the Future Orchestra to its greatest effect. It's like, and he does it again in the end, and I don't think he does it at all in Pine Bluff variant. I feel like I feel like the end, and then I feel like a few minor episodes in season 6 randomly get some Fight the Future music treatment, which is it's funny because the music is so great that it's jarring because I'm like, wait, this is too grand. It's not working.
It's too much.
This is not a movie. I love you, Mark Snow. I am not dogging on you, I promise. But it is one of those things I feel like this is one of the moments that I'm too geeky about this show because I can instantly pick that out and be like, oh.
Well, this is part of the problem for me is I've listened to the Fight the Future soundtrack so many times that any, like, I can identify it within, like, two notes, you know, like the old show Name That Tune. I can name that tune in two notes. Yeah, for sure. Any Fight the Future music. So that's definitely a sort of the next wild geek problem.
But great as always. I just had to give him a shout.
Always great. We love you, Mark Snow.
So, okay, my plot related question, and I could have gone back and watched this again because even though I've seen this a million times, I think I wonder it every time. Do you think they're actually showing this broadcast or is it sort of a closed circuit system and they're faking the guy out?
I think I used to be confused about that, but I was paying extra special attention this week. Mm-hmm. And Roger Cross very briefly mentions, and it is very quick aside, it's we're at closed circuit back to the building. And so it's a very quick little line, but they're not broadcasting it. Although I think that they probably could have explained that a lot more clearly.
Yeah, because
there's nothing else about it that makes it seem that way. It all seems very real, which obviously is intentional. They wanted to make it seem real, but I think they probably should have explained it to the viewer a bit more clearly.
I think it would have been responsible, even though we know that they're not entirely always responsible about these things, but for them to have a line that clarified that, like, even just the news reporter being like, okay, so wait, I'm just I'm going to talk to this guy like it's real, like something briefly, because
something
especially
when something to set up the reporter, because she's like, you know, in the middle of her stand-up. Because
you're
when
watching
we see her.
It like it's real. And then you're like, oh, wait, they're actually putting this guy on the news. Okay. Okay. Well, I'm glad to know that line. I'll have to go back and double check that because
I agree. They should have made it a lot clearer because, you don't want to be broadcasting that, and you don't want people to think that you would broadcast that.
Right.
So it would be, I think that especially the reporter being outside seeming very much like a typical reporter in that scenario.
Yeah.
They could have shown, I think a little clip of, you know, telling her just like, you know, just, you know, do it like you normally would.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't worry. No one's going to see it. Just do it like you normally would.
What you just said took 3 seconds, and like that's just one of those things that they could have added, and then it would have made it clearer. Yeah,
much clearer.
But I do rest easy knowing that that was the intention. So
it was the intention.
There we go. Okay, cool. So is there anything else you want to say about this hostage situation? I mean, like, other than the fact that it's just wonderfully acted by everyone in this group, like,
really,
I think
really,
all the
really
hostages
well done. That's,
are great.
I think that's
everyone's
why,
great.
Yeah, that's why it kind of, like, sort of just, you know, kind of scared me a little bit, because we did watch a simulation video as part of our active shooter training at work, and that was meant to be, like, very, very accurate. Like, they had real police officers in it. They had real guns in it. And everything about it was meant to be super realistic. And this looked so much like that. Mm-hmm. It seemed very, very accurate to me.
And I mean, at least I keep comparing it to Dwayne Barry, because it's the other situation we have that's very similar. I mean, at least Dwayne Barry, at one point, Mulder's able to sort of talk him into letting some people go.
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, no, he straight up shoots someone. Like,
he is not playing.
They're not pulling any punches. Like, he is not playing. And I mean, I think that's the moment too, that like, that's such a huge decision to have him do that, because you, in that moment, even though we're trying to sort of be on this guy's side, you sort of lose him a little bit. Like, you just shot someone. And I mean, at that point, we're all thinking, okay, well, there's clearly something going on here. But these people aren't really zombies. I mean, come on. Like, you know, you're thinking something
like
that.
Don't be shooting anybody. Come on now.
Yeah. Like, I mean, even though I'm believing that this guy is evil, this boss is evil, and he's doing something to these people, like, I seriously don't want to see Gary shooting somebody, you know?
Yeah.
So at that point, I feel like we're like, oh, shit, just got real. And I feel like that's an interesting and actually really good decision. I think a good writer's decision, a good choice to have that in, because it makes it harder to sympathize with this guy.
And it makes the actions that are taken throughout the rest of that scene seem very reasonable and rational, and we're not distracted by any question of should they have shot him or not. We know at that point that they had to, so we don't think, oh, well, you know, this seems a little heavy-handed. That's not the story they're trying to tell. So it makes every action taken against him seem very reasonable and very much called for. So that way we can kind of like not get hung up on that.
Right. Absolutely. So I think the next thing that we need to talk about is David Duchovny's effortless transition from sort of, I'm just sort of weighing the situation, I don't know what to make of it, into completely sort of flummoxed, I would say is the word, but also sort of terrified and paralyzed with this idea that, oh God, I'm really trying hard not to believe this, but it's real. Like, you know, again, he does it so well that you don't even notice it. You don't notice how well he's doing it. And I feel like David Duchovny is sort of the proverbial car that if it's running smoothly, we don't pay it any mind.
Yeah,
like, that's sort of what he is. Like, he is just so reliable in his portrayal of Mulder that I don't know. I want to point that out when it happens because I don't think he gets enough credit. But he's so good. He's so good
in this
moment where he realizes that the monster is real, and he's sort of shell-shocked about it. He doesn't even really know if he wants to say anything to Scully yet, but he still kind of wants some more information. And then at a certain point, she is the one to be like, let's go. Like, why are you talking to this guy?
Yeah. And I like the way he kind of like at the end of that scene when Scully says to Mulder, I like the fact that she says to him, what's going on? And she doesn't say what's wrong with you or like knock it off or
yeah, she
what
can
is happening.
It's read like, him. Like
she just wants to know. She thinks that he's being weird in his questioning of Pincus, but she just wants to know why. She's not giving him a hard time, which I really like. And I like the way Duchovny delivers the whole I don't know. Like he just seems so tired and like a little bit scared of like the situation in which he finds himself, and like he just genuinely doesn't know, and he's kind of frustrated and sort of in a bit of a state at that point. So I like that. I like that little exchange.
Yeah, and the fact that like the Mulder of a few episodes previous would have probably taken her aside in this room and been like, "The guy, I saw it. The guy, like he's telling the truth." And his hesitation here, I think, speaks to that arc that we're witnessing in season 5, which I think is really interesting. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, yeah, good point.
The fact that we have to wait an entire other scene where he clearly has not slept for a couple of days and he's doing all this research because. And I think he genuinely wants Scully to prove him wrong. That's at the end of the day, like he's practically begging her. He's like, please do this autopsy, because if you do and you find nothing, then I can move on. But like without
then we know that I am crazy.
I think he's hoping that she finds nothing. Because I think at the end of the day, like even in this sort of lines up with what he says later in the mental facility when he's like, well, we both knew it would come to this. Like he's doubting his own sanity at this point.
I think that he is. I think that that's a really good point. Mm-hmm. And especially that scene in the office where Scully, who we always know Scully is right and insightful. And the first thing she says to him is, you know, have you slept? And he does seem a little bit crazy. He does seem slightly unhinged.
Yeah.
You know, in the way that Mulder gets sometimes, but particularly here with his whole linking things together on the map. And, you know, it's interesting to me the way that Mulder starts to act more and more like Gary as the episode unfolds from there on out. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of the start of that, where he seems a little crazy.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was, you know what, when I was watching it this week, I was trying to decide where does Mulder fall on this? Like when he asks Scully to do the autopsy, he does genuinely seem to be like almost wanting her to find nothing. Yeah. So that like, I think in a way he's saying that just to kind of appeal to her in a way, like, well, you know, if you're right, prove it. But I think in a way, in his mind, my best interpretation of his behavior throughout this episode is he honestly isn't sure if he's crazy or not. I think that he becomes quite convinced that he's right as he goes along. But I think there are times in the episode where he's not really sure. And this is one of those times that he's not totally sure. Is he crazy? Is he not? I think he becomes more convinced. But I think we as viewers also aren't sure, totally sure. Is he crazy or is he not?
Yeah, I think we're kind of stuck in the middle because I feel like Scully is doing everything that she needs to be doing. But at the same time, like sort of her refusal to indulge him here is slightly frustrating to me because it's like, it feels like she's not indulging Gary when I'm like, no, you don't. You're indulging Mulder, like your friend, your partner who needs your help. Like that's kind of how I felt about the scene.
I did find it a little, they didn't to me give a good enough reason for Scully not to just do the autopsy. I mean, she's done autopsies for lesser reasons than this.
Exactly.
But like you say, she makes some kind of a weird sort of assertion that gives credence to the delusions of Gary. And it's like, I don't think that's going to matter to anyone at this point.
That's stubbornness. Like to me, like at the end of the day, like even Scully is just looking for truth. Like, and so, and I don't want to say like I was out of character because I don't think it's out of character at all. I think that she is at first and foremost, what's consistent about Scully is that she, first of all, is always asking after his mental health because that's what she does. Are you okay? What's wrong? Have you slept? Like that's always her, the first thing that she says, because her number one priority is let's make sure that he's in working order. So it's not in any way out of character. And especially later in the episode when she eventually does do it. Even though she's kind of has to be strong-armed and do it, she does do it. But it's just one of those things where I think that like her sort of care and concern for him, I think sometimes can come off as slightly callous. And I don't want to say that as like, because I really, really don't think that with my whole chest in this scene. I'm just like, just making a slight comment. I'm like, well, this is one of those times, Scully, where he's like asking you to prove him wrong. Like he's begging you. He's kind of like,
he wants you to.
Yeah. He's like, just do the autopsy.
He's up for it.
You think you're going to find nothing, and you're probably going to find nothing. And if you do find nothing, you're going to put it into my suffering. So just do it. And so, I mean, I sort of understand his sort of, well, I'll go do it without you, even though it's very petulant and very childish and very Mulder of him to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I get it. Like, I get his sort of reaction. He's going through a thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense in that context. It's an interesting sort of situation that they're in there where Scully is concerned for Mulder's sort of mental well-being at that moment, I think, which, you know, we certainly see again. And I wouldn't be surprised if the reason that she refuses to do the autopsy in reality is because in her mind, I mean, I'm just kind of connecting it with sort of the therapy I've had for anxiety and for sort of like false beliefs and, you know, kind of slightly deluded beliefs, that the typical therapy is not to check that thing out. If I think that there's something amiss, if that something is irrational, it feels to me like the best way to resolve that is to just literally go and check the evidence. Is there, you know, is there in fact a mouse in my basement? But in reality, I'm supposed to tell myself, no, there's no reason for me to believe this. And going to check it is just what they call reassurance seeking behavior. Yeah. And that's not going to help my anxiety in the long run. It's going to make me feel better right at this moment, but it's not going to help my mental illness. And so I wonder if that's what Scully's kind of thinking here is, yes, this may address this issue at this second.
Yeah.
But there's a bigger problem here with Mulder's mental health. And
that's
I don't want to like feed his delusions. I want to just cut it off at the quick. Go home, get some sleep. You'll be fine. Yeah. I don't know if she grasps how deep he's into this at this point.
Well, and she obviously doesn't grasp that what he's seeing is actually real.
Well, clearly not.
She's Scully. But yeah, exactly. That actually is a really good
point. I think she's like, yep, yeah, like, point. You know, it's, she's, you know, being kind in kind of like, you know, she sounds harsh, but she's doing it for his benefit. It's like, I'm not going to feed into your reassurance seeking behavior. That will just extend this whole experience for you. Let's just cut it off at the quick.
Right.
So I wonder if I'm trying to sort of explain to myself why she was acting that way. That's kind of my sort of headcanon.
That's interesting. And I apologize for bringing this up, but that makes me think about later and like the whole idea of the MSR breakup and like,
yeah,
the idea that even though it took her so many years, that she finally reached a point where she's doing exactly what you're saying. Like, I can't feed into this anymore. I'm done.
Yeah.
And
I think this is like a flash of that.
Yes.
This is just like a moment where she actually does it. Like maybe she's just really worried about him or just like not in the mood for it that day. Either way, this is like she gets obviously much more. She embraces this position much more in later years. But there's just like a moment where she decides to try it.
Yeah.
It doesn't work out particularly well. But,
right.
but
and
she
it's...
realizes eventually that she's going to have to stick to her guns.
It's interesting because the way they sort of make it happen ultimately is like Skinner essentially makes her do it. Like, oh, well, Mulder said you're doing this thing. And she, rather than argue, she's just going to do what the men say and go do it. But like at the same, I don't want to make it sound like that. But at the same time, it's like she's just kind of like, honestly, I feel like she's even taking that as an out, like, because there's part of her, like you said, there's part of her that doesn't want to do it. And then there's probably a part of her that does want to do it.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Skinner is giving her permission and giving her an excuse to go do this.
Absolutely.
Oh, I have to do it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the reason that she does agree to do it is because she doesn't want Mulder to look bad at that moment. Skinner's like, didn't you know you were doing this? And if she says, well, Mulder didn't even tell me, that makes him look a little bit more.
Yeah.
Unbalanced and a little bit more out of control, and she wants to pretend like everything is cool right now. So it's like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go do it right now. That's right. So I think I'm okay kind of with that situation. And to your point that, you know, part of her wants to do it anyway, I think you're right that I think part of her does want to do it and did want to do it in the first place, mm-hmm. but just felt like she shouldn't, that, you know, I don't want to get, this is sort of like, you know, all part of the whole folie à deux concept is, you know, she just wanted to make sure she stayed out of it. And the more involved she got, the more sort of swept up into potentially his delusion she would get.
Right.
And I think she was trying to resist that. I think that, I mean, that's sort of the question of the episode is, you know, is it possible that this is in fact a delusion that's being shared by two people, by Mulder and Scully? Is it possible that they are experiencing folie à deux?
Yeah.
I think generally speaking, we don't think so, but it's never totally, you know, it's always a possibility through most of the episode. And certainly I think if we look at it from that perspective, that Scully is aware of that as an issue, because they've already talked about the folie à deux theory in the office when Scully suggests it to Mulder that that's why he feels this way.
Right.
That this is a case of folie à deux. And shout out again to Vince Gilligan that Mulder knows the term folie à deux, so he actually seems like a psychologist for a moment,
yes.
which is a wonderful and rare thing to see.
I love those moments where he brings, or the Helsinki syndrome, like he'll bring up like
yes.
Stockholm syndrome, something that makes
he
you remember. Oh, he knows all these things. It's
yes.
like The Field Where I Die when he brought up the whatever the book is that talks about all the different.
Oh, yeah. The Diagnostic Statistical Manual of
Thank
Psychiatric
you.
Conditions.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whatever. Even just a slight mention of that and you're reminded that he is actually this brilliant profiler. I love
That's
when they bring
right.
those things
Yeah,
up.
I love
yeah.
that moment. So, you know, they've already addressed the question of folie à deux. So I wonder if it's just lingering a little bit in the back of Scully's mind. Like, I don't want to get sucked into this, too. But
yeah.
yet at the same time, she kind of wants to. It's intriguing.
That's
what happens. You get sucked into other people's delusions potentially.
Yeah. And I think while this episode is really scary and a great X-File and all of those awesome things, I feel like thematically it's kind of underrated in the fact that this is really sort of talking about their symbiotic relationship, that like mm-hmm. her sort of indulging his delusions, it kind
yeah.
of goes feeds back into her. And
yeah.
it's this cyclical, like,
it becomes a bit of a feedback loop.
Yes. And I mean, even though they're not saying that, we know X-Files is so great with subtext, that that's sort of what they're saying. They're like, at the end of the day, it's these two. It's the madness shared by two. They mm. don't make sense together. And yet somehow they make this sort of perfect sense. And
yeah.
even the whole concept behind this episode and the title of it is shippy. So I enjoy that. But, you know,
it's very interesting to me. Yeah, I think the whole folie à deux concept plays out throughout the episode in an interesting way. First between Mulder and Gary and then between Mulder and Scully. And it's mm-hmm. very, very interesting the way. And folie à deux is, in fact, like a real psychiatric sort of condition. I think it's called, I want to call shared delusional disorder, I think is the term that's usually used. So it does actually happen where it's usually, interestingly enough, usually it's two people, it can be more, but if it's two people, folie à deux, mm-hmm. it's often people, those two people are somehow isolated from the rest of society, and one of them tends to have the stronger delusion and kind of gives it to the second person. And so this is kind of an interesting model of the way that condition can unfold, because there's Mulder and Scully, they are quite isolated down there in the basement. They really only kind of have each other in a lot of ways. And Mulder's the sort of more prominent person in the partnership who sort of gives his delusion to Scully and she receives it. It was very sort of interesting sort of reading about the condition and the sort of parallels with Mulder and Scully's relationship, if one were inclined to look upon it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, we're not supposed to believe that that's what's going on between them, but you could look at it that way if you so chose.
Exactly. And I mean, again, it's up to the viewer's interpretation. I mean, what you
yeah.
want to think is actually going on. I think maybe thematically it doesn't really change the idea of what we're supposed to be getting out of the episode. Mm-hmm. But I think that's probably applicable to every single episode.
Yeah.
So
there's just a couple of different layers going on here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Love it.
We love the layers.
Gotta love the layers. So there's a lot of, like, you know, footwork that goes on for several scenes of Mulder kind of chasing this guy. But I feel yeah. like I don't really have much to add until the scene with Skinner in the office when we see the bug behind Skinner, because I feel like that's the moment where even we as the viewer are watching, and we completely understand why Skinner thinks Mulder has just lost his mind.
Oh, absolutely. You know, sometimes I would think that there's been times where I thought, did they really need to, like, restrain Mulder in the hospital so thoroughly? It seems a little over the top. But then I kind of remembered as I was watching it, he literally tried to kill a guy. Like, yeah. He pulled out his gun, and to everyone outside of the situation, it looks like he tried to pull his gun and shoot a perfectly innocent civilian.
Yeah.
And so he's clearly a little violent.
Yeah.
So I can, it makes total sense that they're like, geez, Louise, we got to put this guy in an institution and strap and bandage. Either that or throw him into a jail cell because he's dangerous.
And I think, and not to bring up the Pusher connections again, but I think this is interesting coming off, I mean, not very recently, but several episodes ago, we had Kitsunagari, which was the follow-up to Pusher, which was another one in which both Skinner and Scully were questioning Mulder's sanity and were questioning his fitness to kind of follow up on the case,
right,
to the point where, like, he got removed from the case.
Yeah.
And so
we should have done that.
Yeah. Right. It was one of those situations where this seems like the logical conclusion to having that already have happened recently, too.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Mulder it's has clearly been going through some shit this season. And
yeah, he really
it makes
has.
Sense.
He's just a little on edge. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to me, sort of, again, the parallels with Gary. He becomes more and more Gary-like through the episode. Like, when they arrive at Gary's home, they see a map on the wall that's exactly, I think, identical, I think, to the one that Mulder had drawn in their office.
Mm-hmm.
So we see he's gone Gary-like in that sense. And then there's the whole scene where the monster gets into this employee's house, Gretchen, and attacks her, this woman. A scary scene.
With that creepy, like, what, Shirley Temple?
Yeah, like tap dancing with this really super creepy music somehow. Like, oh my God, I don't know. The X-Files are the best at looking at things that are not meant to be remotely creepy and finding the creepiness in them.
Yeah. Oh my God. A friend of mine brought up the recent theory that was like, I think that pretty much anytime some sort of old timey, like, pop culture is happening, you could expect some crazy, scary shit to go down. And I mean, like, she brought up the Hokey Pokey in Chinga. And I was like, well, wonderful Johnny Mathis in Home.
Yeah.
Like, this is the kind of thing. Like, it's when you're watching a horror movie and then you hear, like, children singing, which should be the most wonderfully just benign thing on earth, but it's somehow the most scary thing you can possibly conceive.
I love
of.
That the X-Files does that better than anything else, in my opinion. So I love that. And
great.
then in the office afterwards, and this is the start of the scene that we're talking about when Mulder finally loses his shit totally. Gretchen is there, and as the scene starts, this is such great writing by Vince Gilligan, right? As the scene starts, Gretchen is talking about, I became aware of this presence and I could feel it creeping towards me. It was terrifying. And the next thing I knew, and then she looks at Mulder and says, this madman's inside my house, breaks my window, kicks down my door. And the whole time he's screaming about monsters. I mean, he's even worse than Gary. So that's such an interesting scene, because at the start, it looks like she's going to talk. She's talking about the monster. Mm-hmm. But then it turns out she's actually talking about Mulder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like the pinnacle of, like, the Gary-ness of Mulder in this episode, is that he is, according to the witnesses, acting in a very Gary-like fashion. And he's at that point where he seems crazy, because not just because he's seen the monster, but it's a question that Mulder brings up earlier. You know, is he crazy because, you know, is he delusional because he's seen the monster, or does he see the monster because he's delusional?
Yeah.
And at this point, I think it's both for Mulder. Like, he's going a little crazy. He seems crazy to people because he sees the monster, but that's not why we, the viewer, know he's crazy. But he is getting a little unhinged at that point. He is getting a little over the top with his behavior, because he's so frustrated, and he's, you know, kind of, obviously he's really, like, throwing himself into this case and probably not getting enough sleep or anything else. And at that point he's getting, you know, just a little on edge. And so he's definitely a little crazy on every possible level at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if he is seeing, it's like, yeah, like you said, even if you are seeing something, you're still going to appear to others as crazy, and you still are acting kind of crazy. So
he was still acting pretty crazy. He was not like, you know, he wasn't coming across as a convincing person at that point. Mm-mm. No one was going to believe him about the monster because he just seemed super crazy.
I do love, and I mean, we'll talk about the loony bin scene here now, if you're ready, because we might as
well. Yeah, let's.
I do love that when Scully comes in, she's instantly, like, she's not scared of him. Like, she's not afraid
of
him.
I like that, yeah.
And that is one of those things that continues throughout the series. Like, I love that. It's like, no matter what, Scully's like, no, he wouldn't hurt me. Like, I know that's not going to happen. I mean, she literally even says that in, what was it, Biogenesis. Yeah. She says that, and she knows, she immediately comes in, holds his hand. Which is very sweet. Love it.
And I love the way that Kim Manor shot that, where we don't know it's Scully yet. We just see someone coming in, and she takes his hand, and it's like, it's Scully.
We know. Yeah. And it's the first moment in the episode that we get that is that sort of human connection, that physical connection. And so the second we see that, we're like, okay, we're grounded now. Like, we got it. Scully's here. She... You know, maybe she doesn't entirely buy what's going on, but she's here for Mulder. And I really do enjoy that, like, even he can sort of appreciate the humor of the situation. I love his line when he's like, well, this was going to happen at some point.
Yeah, 5 years together, Scully, you must have seen this coming. I love that line. And he just gives this heartbreaking little laugh afterwards, like, haha, joke, but I'm almost crying. Mm-hmm. Like,
because he can't do anything about it. Like, he's so powerless in this scene.
He's
almost powerless.
To watch. And I think he is kind of questioning his own sanity a tiny bit at that point, too. And he's just so, like, I don't know what to think anymore. And he's at the end of his rope, I think. Mm-hmm. He's really screwed up. So, and you're right that Scully is so, she clearly doesn't believe him at this point. I mean, she plainly says to him, you know, something like, you know, my hope is that you'll get past this delusion. She still clearly believes it's a delusion. Mm-hmm. But she's still full of caring and compassion for him just because she believes he's being rather crazy. It doesn't take away from the fact that it's Mulder. She's not scared of him. She doesn't care any less for him.
Right.
She's all care and compassion. And that's a very nice thing that, you know, whatever he does, she may not believe him, but she'll always be there for him. And that's their relationship.
Well, and I think, I think an even finer point on it, I would say she may not believe in the things that he believes in, but she always believes in him.
Absolutely.
I would probably phrase it that way. Like, and she knows that whatever's going on with him is real to him. And I think she can appreciate that. And I enjoy seeing that kind of play out in scenes like this. And I was going to ask you what you think is actually going on in this final scene, because I have a little bit of a theory and I'm wondering what you think of it.
Like, starting when Scully arrives back at the hospital?
Well, when she finally sees.
When she sees the zombie lady.
And then
she sees the zombie lady first, the nurse.
It comes out of nowhere. Like, it's like she's...
It seems to come out of nowhere. I'll be very interested to hear your theory, because I'm kind of curious about this myself. It's an interesting sort of, like, journey that Scully goes on in the course of this episode. And while sort of on the surface, she's still saying it's a delusion, I don't believe this, I think in the back of her mind, she is starting to believe, maybe even subconsciously, a little bit more throughout the episode. Like, starting even with the first autopsy, there's the question of time of death. Even though she does kind of hand wave that away later on, it does kind of stick with her a little bit. And then, of course, when Mulder tells Scully to, hey, check the back of his neck, again, she doesn't think she's going to find anything, but at that point she buys in enough and she believes in Mulder enough to go and do it. And so, and she finds these marks after shaving off that neck hair, which I never enjoyed watching. Yeah. It's just like, that's the part where she blows on it and it all flies into the air. It's very real looking, but I don't need to see that. And so she has seen that. So I feel like in the back of her mind, even though she may not have articulated it yet, It's just, it's all working away there in the back of her mind. It's sort of like in Clyde Bruckman, where she figures out who the killer is because it's all been just sort of simmering in her subconscious the whole time. And so I think that that maybe it was simmering in her subconscious. Now, what triggered it at that precise moment is interesting because it, I, you know, to me, it's something to do with believing that Mulder's in trouble and that she's concerned about him. And that for some reason at that moment, maybe her love for Mulder is what allows her to see the truth of what's happening and that she somehow becomes in sync with his beliefs. And that's why it happens at that moment. That's kind of my half-baked theory.
Okay, well, my theory is similar. I agree with you completely that, like, she already at this point is sort of willing. She's willing to see, even though she's not admitting it to Mulder. She's
right. Or even to herself, necessarily.
Yeah, she's already willing to see. And I think that's why when he says that to her and he says, which, you know, the iconic line, he says, "You have to be willing to see. You're the only one on the whole damn planet who believe me. You're my 1 in 5 billion.
Yeah. Such a, I mean, isn't that a great line? Can we just shout out to Vince Gilligan for writing that incredibly beautiful line? And that's, it works on Scully because that's when she decides to go back and check the body again. Well, why wouldn't you? If someone said that to me, I'd do whatever they wanted me to do.
Exactly. I think that she already, because of Mulder, is willing to see. And so my sort of theory is that when she's, you know, she checks the neck and finds the thing and she comes back to tell Mulder, she is in the vicinity of Mulder. She is the one in that room that is the most, I would say vulnerable isn't really the right word, but the most willing to believe. Yeah. Open-minded. And I feel like the same thing happened to Mulder in that hostage situation, whereas he was the one person in that room that was going to believe Gary. And so he was the one person right before Gary was about to die. I feel like that's the key. That's the trigger. Right before Gary was about to die, Mulder was able to see. And I feel like Mulder was about to die. He was literally about to be attacked. Same sort of situation. And that's the moment that Scully, the most willing to see, the other of the two, the adieu in this room, was able to see in that moment. So that's kind of my theory. That
I like that a lot.
And I mean, it's not, I don't think it's any less romantic because I think that she already was willing to see. That's the romantic part. She was there. She was there to go tell him what she found. You know what I mean?
She
was
already there in a state of mind to kind of communicate with him that, like, you're not so crazy after all, my friend. And she is worried about him, I think, when the nurse is being so obstructive. She's really quite, Scully is not going to be put off. So she's a little bit concerned at that point, I think.
But
I like that idea that she's the most willing to believe because we never really find out what is it? What is it about? Who's able to see this and why are they able to see it?
Right.
You know, Mulder throws out a couple of theories early on, but we never have any sense about what the mechanism is or what the explanation is for why some people, only very, very few people can see this monster.
Mm-hmm.
So we're left to, you know, we can theorize as we see fit. And I like your theory a lot.
Cool. Well, I mean, the outcome is the same. You know, Scully, because of her belief in Mulder, for no other reason, she runs in and essentially is able to save his life, which, again, this is something that happens constantly on this show, which is something that I love. At the end of the day, Scully is able to come save Mulder because she believes in him, and I love that. But this is one of those things where they're clever by making the room dark, because then later she has her typical plausible deniability that we need to hear from Scully, But I also feel like it's very believable in this scenario because she has not had the same situation as Mulder. Like, she has not suffered this for days and days and been having this wave. She literally saw it once and then it was gone. And then, so she is able to square that in her mind that I know that I saw something. Like, I know it was not human. It was a thing. I know that I saw some sort of monster, that Mulder was right. But at the end of the day, I, Scully, am going to chuck this up to Folly Adieu. And I love the idea that Mulder just sort of accepts that. Because it's kind of like, it's over, you know? And at the end of the day, narratively and thematically, it is the two of them. It just ends up with the two of them having this story that they cannot confirm or deny to any sort of outside source. Yeah. And I find that really, really compelling and interesting, and a really great ending for them in this
episode.
Yeah,
I like it a lot. And, you know, we can't have, of course, you know, Scully being Scully, we can't suddenly have her believe the monsters. And but it is, you know, it is believable that she would think it was folie à deux, whether she genuinely believes that in her heart of hearts, or if that's just something she's telling herself or just telling Skinner, who knows?
Well, but like you alluded to earlier, maybe Mulder even believes it too.
Yeah,
like,
maybe.
They might both chalk this up to folie à deux.
Like, we don't know for sure.
No.
They don't know for sure at that point. And yeah, I try to read Mulder's face as the elevator doors are closing after she says folie à deux, menace here by two. And it's an enigmatic expression. Like sometimes to me, it looks a little bit like he's a little bit like, oh, geez,
disappointed.
Same old,
yeah.
Or like, yeah, shoulder shrug. And sometimes it is kind of like, you know, acceptance, like you're suggesting, I think. But it's interesting. You can interpret it however you want. It's an interesting expression. I think it's the kind of thing that every time I watch it, I'll probably have a different theory about it, which is great.
Yeah, I love the inscrutability of his facial expressions at times. Like it's
very inscrutable.
It's good, and I mean, at the end of the day, maybe the fact that he knows Scully saw something is enough.
Yeah.
Like that's
well,
enough.
Yeah.
And I mean, and that plays in greatly to like later we see Fight the Future. Like he just wants her to see it. Like he at the spaceship, you got to see this. Like, and then, you know, we've had debates about this before, but like at the end of the day, I think we both landed on that. Like canonically, she says to him that she saw it.
Yeah.
Even though we don't hear it, that's like what she says. And
yeah.
So his smile, like I have to interpret that way. Like he's so thrilled that whatever this was, it doesn't matter, but that we both saw this, like the two of us, we both saw this thing. We share this experience. And I feel like to him, that's just everything. Like that's the folie à deux. And
yeah,
that's, I think at the end of the day, probably what matters to him most. And I think that's why I love this episode so much.
That's a great point, because, you know, there's so many times when Scully doesn't see the monster. And this is a time where not only does she see it, she shoots it, or shoots at it at least.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she maybe gets it because, you know, it makes a little bit of a noise at one point. But
it gets away.
That gets away. So, I think you're right. That probably for Mulder, that counts for a hell of a lot. And he is probably... You know, she's not saying she didn't see it. She's not saying that, right. I don't know, I thought I saw something, but I might not have. It could have just been a shadow. She's still sticking to her guns that she saw something. Even if she's going to attribute to folie à deux, it's still part of her experience that she saw it. What fueled that perception is the question, but she's not saying she didn't see it. So that's at least something fresh from Mulder's perspective.
Yep.
And on the subject of the monster getting away, that's the only little tiny narrative quibble I have with this episode is, I mean, it is very X-Files-y, the monster is still out there kind of thing. But I think the thing that troubles me a little bit about this ending, because, you know, basically we see another telemarketing setup and someone else obviously is going to have the Gary experience because he is seeing the monster again. I think the thing that troubles me a tiny bit about it is usually we get the idea, yes, the monster is out there. Where might it go next? We don't know. In this case, the monster isn't just out there. The monster is in the process of victimizing people again. And it's a little less ambiguous, and it's a little bit kind of like part of me feels like, geez, Mulder and Scully went through a hell of a lot only for that monster to get away and for the whole thing just to start over again. Not just might it start over again, we know for sure it is. And so that just doesn't quite sit right with me 100%.
Oh, that's funny that you say that, because every time they end an X-Files episode that way, I just assume that. Like,
I always assume
the monster is still out there. So, I mean, why are we to assume that it's not going to continue doing what it does?
Yeah.
So I don't see a difference here, yeah, other than I think this is a fantastic ending. So
it is a good ending. I mean, it comes back, of course, comes back around to the basically to the beginning with, you know, it's here.
Yeah.
But it's just, I guess, yeah, I agree that typically, you know, when we see the monster going off again, or the monster has somehow survived, we can guess that probably trouble will arise. I guess this one was just a little too spelled out for me. But, I mean, it's probably the best way to have ended it. I mean, it's a strong ending to the episode, sort of, you know, in terms of the note it ends on.
Right.
But I guess poor Mulder and Scully just went through so much. And it just makes me sad that there's like no change at all.
I see what you're saying, but I guess I don't have that issue because, like I said, I feel that way constantly. I feel like that's the name of the game on this show.
It really
like
is,
it's so. they get to see the truth, but at the end of the day, they're completely powerless to it. And
I mean, in the end, there's, yeah, you know, they can never really solve everything. Just keeps happening. And there's only so much they can do to put a stop to the bad things in the world. And it's just, you know, Mulder and Scully don't usually win. And so it's definitely spelled out here. It just makes me sad.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
It makes me a little sad because, boy, they just really went through the ringer in this episode.
But, you know, they have each other.
They have each other. That's the important thing. They're in the elevator together.
Yeah.
Going down to the basement.
It's
so
true.
That's all that really matters.
Back to work, man. Like
back to work.
On to the next.
They are still their partnership is as strong as ever. And while I don't think we have nearly as many sort of overtly shippy moments in this, aside from the 1 in 5 billion, which is a priceless line, we don't have as many overtly shippy moments in this as we would in Pusher, I would argue. But this still is a very shippy episode in its own way.
Yeah, I mean, I think similarly to Pusher, which is also a Vince script, is the fact that at the end of the day, it sort of comes down to the two of them and how they relate to each other and what they think of each other and how they believe in each other, which at the end of the day, I think is the most important and interesting part of this show. So well done, Vince. I think it's a great script. I think it's a great episode. And I do think, I mean, you say their partnership is as strong as ever, which I agree with to an extent. But I do think they appropriately set up all of the cracks that we're about to see.
Yeah.
But, you know, they've been setting these cracks up since day one. So it's fine.
Yeah. No, it all works really well.
Yeah. It's great.
And we're all really curious to see where things are going to go from here. And we surely did.
And we definitely do. And things get crazy real quick.
Oh, they do.
Well, I mean, that's really all I have on my notes for Folie à Deux. Do you have anything else that you want to talk about?
I don't think I do. I think that's pretty much everything I was going to say about it. As always, I had a lot to say about it, but it's just such a really interesting episode in terms of breaking down just the straight narrative, like what's really going on here. And also there's so much interesting character stuff with Mulder as an individual, with Scully as an individual, and with the two of them together. And I got to blather on about psychiatric conditions, which I always enjoy doing.
Well, and I always enjoy hearing it. So it worked out perfectly.
Hey, hey.
Well, thanks for listening, you guys. And definitely hit us up on Twitter. Let us know what you think of this episode. It's at XFD Podcast. And we will be back with you next time with another episode of X-Files Diaries.